If you make that little oof noise every time you stand up, yeah, that's your knees talking. Go see Joint Relief Institute. Fast relief covered by Medicare, 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
So many different stories. We have the Broadview 6, which is a fascinating case, which is you're going to be hearing about, I will tell you, for years in the future. We have the South Carolina attorney, Alex Murdaugh, who had his double murder conviction overturned. We've got a case of Luigi Mangione, who is accused of murdering the United Healthcare executive. And we've got the Harvey Weinstein film mogul, who had a hung jury. So who better to break this all down with us? The founder of Sharonis and Parente, Damon Sharonis. He's an aggressive and effective advocate for people charged with federal, white-collar, violent crimes, drug and sex crimes. He's been involved in many of the high-profile cases across the country, and he's a favorite and a regular of the show. Hi, Damon. How are you doing?
Happy Memorial Day, Karen. I'm doing well.
To you.
I was supposed to start a trial Tuesday, but that got dismissed. So
yes. And that's the Broadway 6 case. And I'm going to hold off on talking about that when we have a little bit of a longer segment, because this is something that really needs some explaining. But why don't we start with Harvey Weinstein? Now, you represented him, along with Donna Rotunno, two Chicago attorneys, went out to New York in the first trial. You represented him. There were some convictions. There were some acquittals. And that those convictions were overturned on appeal. There was a second trial, and there was a hung jury, and a split verdict and a hung jury. And now there was a hung jury on the third trial. Can you tell us a little bit about why you think this is happening, why it's been so hard to convict him when there seems to be a lot of women who have come forward, maybe even 80 women who have come forward to complain about his conduct?
Well, I think that the truth of the matter is the evidence against him in the cases were never that strong. They just weren't. First of all, 80 women didn't testify at the first trial. There were a number of complaining witnesses and accusers who testified. And that was one of the reasons the Supreme Court of New York reversed the case, because they thought it was unfair. So what happened was the charges sort of got whittled down. At the second trial, there was one conviction, one acquittal, and then a hung jury. And then the government decided that they wanted to try him a third time. And the woman's name is Jessica Mann. So she was the only alleged victim to testify at the third trial. So it was a single count. The Me Too movement is not any longer sort of in full bloom. There was not a lot of press in the courtroom. I've spoken to the attorneys who tried the case. And frankly, whatever happened, there was so much room for credibility disputes regarding her version of the events, including text messages and emails and staying in touch with them, that it was 9-3 in favor of acquittal. And I'm shocked that it wasn't a straight not guilty. So I think the misunderstanding about Harvey's cases are that these cases were really strong and there was overwhelming evidence. The exact opposite is true. And I think now, you know, with a little bit of time removed from, you know, the Me Too movement, people look at the evidence a little bit more fairly and a little less emotionally.
And, you know, I think what I sort of latched onto when I was listening to some of what the jurors were saying was that, you know, she did stay, the victim, the alleged victim, was in contact with Harvey. And you know, there were some kind exchanges. And again, you know, there's all kinds of literature out there that says that sometimes women who are raped will continue to stay in touch with the perpetrator. But again, I think for people looking at this, you know, it doesn't seem beyond a reasonable doubt, something that they could convict of. And one of the things I was going to ask you about was, I believe I'm right about this, but there were four women on the jury, and all four women voted to acquit, whereas the men voted to convict. Does that ring a bell? Does that make sense to you? And if so, can you explain that?
Absolutely. And when we were picking the jury for the first case, we were sort of trying to figure out what the best jury pool would be. And, you know, obviously I tried the case with Donna Rotunno and there were other women on our team. And the thought process was that based on the nature of this case and the nature of some of these complaining witnesses, that women would more likely reject their testimony than men, because, you know, women have been in relationships and women, not that this has happened to all women or these accusations, but they would have an easier chance of looking through this and seeing that some of it was just not credible, where we were worried that men who may not have been in this situation would not understand it and credit the testimony of the complaining witnesses. So it does not surprise me at all that the female jurors voted to acquit, which means that they just didn't prove it, right? It doesn't, you know, we don't know what happened, but it means that the evidence did not rise to the highest level that we command in this country, thank God, that they just didn't know beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's what some of the jurors said. I watched some of the, you know, videos, the news clips of the jurors, and they just said, look, she was not credible. She said things on direct examination, but when she was cross-examined, she didn't remember anything, and there were all of these impeachment materials. So I think they got it right. You know, I just was surprised that the three others wouldn't come around.
Let's talk about the Broadview 6, Damon. We just had Locke Bowman on the show talking a little bit about his quest to have the state's attorney step down and have a special prosecutor appointed, which was denied. And related to this and related to the blitz and all of this stuff are the Broadway 6. Can you briefly tell our listeners who the Broadway 6 are and were, and then what happened this week with the case that was set to go to trial on Tuesday?
Sure. The Broadview 6 were six individuals who were charged in federal court because they were protesting outside of the ICE detention center in Broadview during the Midway Blitz. And essentially, the government's allegations were an ICE vehicle was trying to get into the Broadway detention center, and that, you know, numerous individuals surrounded the truck and tried to impede him from entering. Our position, and I represented, along with Chris Parenti, Brian Straw, who was a village trustee and a lawyer from Oak Park, was that the vehicle really turned into this crowd and kept driving, and they were in front of him, and they were not trying to impede anyone. That's the layout of what the case is, and a lot of the individuals, all of the individuals who were charged, had some political affiliation with the Democratic Party. So from the beginning, we thought this was potentially politically motivated.
Okay, so this all, these charges get brought, and at some point, the grand jury transcripts become at issue. Can you tell our listeners just a little bit about what would have preceded these charges, what a grand jury would have looked at, and how the transcripts came to issue?
Oh, man, I will just say that this case was dismissed last week in federal court. I've been doing this for 25 years, and I've never seen anything like I saw, and we can talk about that in a second.
I agree.
A grand jury.
Never.
Yeah. And to be there was really something amazing. But a grand jury is an investigative body convened by the U.S. Attorney's Office, and they are supposed to review evidence that is presented only by the government. Defense attorneys don't get to be there. And once that evidence is presented, they are asked to vote for what's called the true bill, which means to indict. And, you know, some people, as the U.S. attorney said in court, refer to it as the conscience of the community. It is meant to be a buffer between the government and the people, so the government just can't indict whomever they want. In reality, the old saying in Chicago is a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. However, the Operation Midway Blitz and the immigration cases that have been brought around the country have been getting a lot of pushback from grand jurors, which shows that they are doing their jobs the way they should. So essentially, whenever you hear of an indictment, that means the case was presented to a grand jury and they returned charges.
Okay, so what brought the issue of the grand jury to the forefront here?
So from the beginning of the case, the lawyers on the case we smelled a rat. We thought it was very fishy how this case was charged with a conspiracy, and then over and over they kept sort of changing their theories. And my partner, as you stated, really sort of led the charge on this, Chris Parenti, who's a great lawyer and a former federal prosecutor. We kept pushing. We wanted the grand jury transcripts. Now, normally, we're not entitled to the grand jury transcripts unless somebody who is in front of the grand jury testifies, because then we're entitled to them under, it's called 3500 material. But we kept pushing, and we pushed so hard that the government then said, we are going to dismiss the felony count, right? Because that is what is brought in front of the grand jury. So they dismissed the charges, and all that was left with them was a misdemeanor. We didn't stop pushing, because now we thought something was really weird. I mean, they were preparing for a conspiracy trial. They were gung-ho about it, and they did not turn over the grand jury transcripts. So we kept pushing for the grand jury transcripts, and we eventually got them, and the judge eventually got them.
And parts were redacted. So there was kind of a cover-up. I mean, they were covering up certain things that happened. And just briefly, without getting into too much of the details, what did you see there? What was the judge called this basically misconduct? And the U.S. attorney in Chicago, who holds the top post, basically said, yes, it wasn't good conduct. I don't know if he used the word misconduct, but he basically admitted that this was not appropriate. So what were the prosecutors doing that violated their ethics?
Well, there's a couple issues. First, the judge was very upset that she received redacted transcripts because she was under the impression that there was nothing in those transcripts that would be misconduct, right? So, you know, during the course of the hearings, it did not seem that she was too interested in them. But when she got them in an unredacted form, because they had taken out all of the alleged misconduct, she sent a minute order telling us we need to be in court the next day. And she said something great. She said, I teach my children, if you make a mistake, you own up to it and you move on. What you don't do is lie about it and cover it up. And that's what she said in court. And she went on to say that she had never seen, and she was the U.S. attorney, Judge Perry, who I've known for years. And I had have a ton of respect for her as a judge, and I have respect for her as a prosecutor. She said she's never seen this type of conduct before a grand jury. And I will say what she said without saying what actually happened to the grand jury. What she found problematic was that there was vouching for the case. In other words, a prosecutor is not supposed to say to grand jurors, trust me, this is a good case. She said that there was also grand jurors who were dismissed who did not want to indict. So they didn't want to indict, so they were told to leave. There were ex parte communications, which you're not supposed to have, with grand jurors. And there were misinstructions on the law. So it was really a really wicked stew of problems for the government, which what they should have done was just dismiss the whole case months ago, but they sort of doubled down. And then once we got those transcripts, the U.S. attorney came in and dismissed the case.
How much of a problem is this? I mean, I will say, you know, and I have practiced in the area of criminal law in other parts of my legal life. And, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office, whether you think they're too aggressive or not, they usually do a pretty good, honest job. And I have a lot of respect for the U.S. attorneys over the years in Chicago who have prosecuted Democrats, Republicans, it didn't really matter. They were non-denominational and they were equal in their, in their pursuing crime. And this doesn't seem like something a U.S. attorney would do in Chicago. Is this out of character in your opinion?
Well, look, you know, I've been working over in that building for over two decades, and I have a very good relationship with them. I fight hard against them. They fight hard against me. But one of the things Judge Perry said that I think sums it up, there is something called the presumption of regularity. And what that basically means, it's accepted that if somebody from the government says something, it's true, right? It's to be expected and it's true. And what she said in this case was that is no longer the case. And I'm not saying she said that about the entire office, but she certainly said it about this case. And, you know, I don't know whether they had, you know, from on high all the way up to the Department of Justice, you know, how this all happened. But yeah, it's a problem whenever you have grand jury misconduct because it's supposed to be fair. I mean, our clients were indicted and they were charged and they had to deal with legal expenses and their families being scared. And our client's a lawyer and he didn't know if he was going to lose his job and all of these things because the grand jury was not handled the right way. So, you know, I don't want to speak broadly because I do have respect for that office, and I know there's a lot of good U.S. attorneys there. This case just got away from them, and at the end of the day, a long time ago, they should have dismissed it. They should have done what Judge Perry tells her kids to do, own up to it and move on. But they didn't, and she's really concerned about the cover-up, and what we're going to try to do is we're going to try to have a hearing on sanctions where we can call witnesses and we can get to the bottom of what happened, how it happened, who knew about it. We're also trying to get attorney's fees for our clients because they spent a lot of money. So this is not over. But yeah, to your point, Karen, you know, you have to be able to trust the government in these situations, especially when we're talking about grand jury things, because defense attorneys can't be there to advocate. I'm not in a grand jury room. I can't object. I can't make sure things are happening the right way. That's why you have to trust that the process is being followed. And at least in this case, it wasn't. And there's going to be some fallout from that.
As well, there should be. Damon Sharonis, you're going to join us on the other side. Can you give out your contact information briefly for our listeners?
Sure. The best way to get a hold of me or my partner is just find our website. It's www.sharonislaw.com, and that has links to all of our, you know, contact information.
Talking about some of the big criminal cases of the week, and there were a bunch of them. So let's pivot and talk about Luigi Mangione, who's the 28-year-old who was charged with murdering United Healthcare exec in Manhattan in December of 2024. There was a big ruling this week where the judge excluded certain evidence and allowed certain evidence in. Damon, can you tell our listeners a little bit about what the evidence was and what the bases for the rulings were?
Sure. It sounds like it was sort of a split decision. What the judge has suppressed is when he was arrested initially, they went into his bag and they found, I think, a gun magazine, a cell phone, a wallet, a passport, and things like that. The court ruled that that was not a valid search incident to an arrest. Now, what that means is you don't necessarily need a warrant when you arrest somebody on the street to search them, but if you're going to go into their bag, they must be able to immediately access that bag in order for the search to be valid because they could reach for something or get their hands on it. The judge ruled in this instance that he was, I think, in handcuffs and there was no way he could access the bag. So that was suppressed. But they brought him back to the station and they did what's called an inventory search on something else. And an inventory search basically means if you get arrested and you have things with you at the station, the police can inventory the contents of what you have. And he allowed that to come in, and that includes the alleged murder weapon, the manifesto, the silencer. So all the real evidence, the real significant evidence at least, is going to come in because the inventory search withstood constitutional scrutiny, and that's where I think the real heart of the evidence lies.
And, you know, I just had a question about Miranda warnings, just because you see this in the news all the time. You watch true crime and you see people who are given their warnings and then they continue to talk and they continue to not ask for a lawyer. In your experience watching these videos and having clients whom you represent, does giving the Miranda warnings really alert them that they shouldn't be talking or that they should ask for a lawyer, or is this just something that doesn't get paid attention to?
No, I think absolutely it does. You know, first of all, the only time you need to be Mirandized is when you're in custody and subject to questioning. So, right, what oftentimes happens, what the FBI loves to do is they love to show up at your house when you're not in custody, but you're a suspect and ask you questions so they don't have to Mirandize you, right? Because once you are read your Miranda warnings, everybody knows that it's really serious now, whether it's from TV or something else. But if you go up to somebody and they're not in custody and you just, oh, by the way, I've got some questions for you, they're more likely to talk to you. So the giving of Miranda only has to happen when you are in custody, which means you're not free to leave and you reasonably think you are not free to leave, and you're subject to what's called custodial interrogation. So I think the actual hearing of Miranda triggers in somebody's mind, uh-oh, they're in trouble and they should lawyer up, which is exactly what the Miranda decision says it should do, right? So it works, which is why there's a lot of issues as to whether they're given and when they're given.
And do you, when you see a client, continue to speak after that? I mean, I guess my question is, if someone is arrested or someone is being questioned, is the best idea not to say anything, to assert your right to remain silent and to ask for a lawyer, or is there any circumstances whatsoever where you should be talking to the police?
I am on your show quite a bit, and sometimes I give advice. And if there's advice that I could give that I would want somebody to listen to, it's this. If you are arrested and you are asked questions, assert your right to remain silent and call an attorney. Whether you're guilty, whether you're innocent, you need a lawyer at that point. And oftentimes, if you say things, that can be used against you, even in ways you've never considered. And this is not me saying this for sort of professional safety. Oh, I hope somebody calls me. I've seen it throughout the course of my career. Individuals who talk, once they are in custody, rarely ever help themselves.
One final thing on the Mangione case. I read somewhere that he's up to about $1.5 million in his coffers, and this is coming from people who are just donating money to him, to his legal defense, for one reason or another. And there's this idea of jury nullification and the possibility of jury nullification at trial. Can you define what that means? And tell our listeners if you think that's a possibility in a case like this.
Sure. Jury nullification is essentially when you are asking the jury to find your client not guilty for something other than the facts and the law. You appeal to their, you know, sense of fair play, this isn't right, or the person, you know, has a sick mother, or something that has nothing to do with the case. You're trying to nullify the jury to have them return a verdict despite the fact that the evidence shows they're possibly guilty. So you're basically arguing unfair things. In my experience, once a jury gets impaneled, they take it very seriously, and most cases rise or fall on the evidence. This type of case is a murder, right? Jurors are very unlikely to nullify in a murder case, especially if the evidence is overwhelming. Now, in certain cases, does nullification work? And are there ways to argue cases where you're not really nullifying a jury, but you're trying to make certain arguments that you hope a jury latches onto? Absolutely. But in a murder case, especially if the evidence is going to be overwhelming, which it very well may be in this case, I find it hard to believe that a jury could be nullified.
Before we go to break, I'm going to just this. I didn't prepare you on this one, Damon, so you're going to have to fly by the seat of your pants. This comes out of
Massachusetts. What I do every day in court. Come on.
There you go. Massachusetts man was sentenced to 6 months in jail for assault for doing what? For setting loose thousands of bees in the presence of deputies who were trying to evict his friend. His defense was that he had no intent to harm the deputies. He just wanted his bees to enjoy the landscape. What do you think of that? Deadly weapon?
I'm trying to think about,
are bees a deadly weapon?
A beast could absolutely be a deadly weapon. I mean, you know, I think the state would have to establish that he did that with the intent of harming the deputies. I think the facts surrounding it, that his friend was being evicted, it's highly unlikely that it was a coincidence that he did it at that time. So yes, imagine a situation where you release a dog on a police officer or another wild animal, or, you know, absolutely that's something that could lead to criminal charges. And I think his excuse was probably not looked at very credibly.
Not at all, said the jury. And, of course, we will call that a sting operation. Oh, okay.
Oh, I knew it was coming. I was going to say they hit the buzzer pretty quick on the guilty verdict. But
All right. Let's talk about this Virginia assistant principal. In January 2023, you may recall the story. A six-year-old boy in Virginia comes to school with his mother's loaded handgun and shoots his teacher, seriously wounding her. The teacher, to her credit, ushered the kids out to make sure they were safe before she was taken away, and she has ongoing problems relating to her issue of being shot. She got a $10 million verdict against the school for negligence, and the mother, whose gun was in the child's backpack, served 2 years in prison for neglect. Now, the assistant principal of the school was on trial this week on 8 counts of criminal child neglect for not doing a search and not taking care of the situation when she was alerted that this might be the issue. Damon, the case was dismissed. The judge dismissed all counts against her. And now we don't know everything because we're reading it in these media accounts, but what do you think happened and why do you think the judge dismissed the case?
I think the judge's reasoning was that even if you believed everything the government had argued, it wasn't a crime under Virginia law. And she made a comment essentially in her dismissal order saying that if you want this to be a crime, the legislature is going to have to pass different laws. This was a horrible situation, but to try with criminal responsibility, remember criminal, not civil responsibility, but to say that the principal committed a crime, I think was a bridge too far. And I think the court got it right. This was a horrible act, but I don't think you can blame criminally the teacher. I think the judge agreed. Maybe the legislature will respond by writing different laws, but that's why we have the separation of powers. But under current Virginia law, the judge has said it's not happening. you know, there's not enough here. Poor judgment doesn't, even gross mistakes doesn't lead to criminal liability.
And, you know, the thing that I'm seeing here is this idea that the government is really trying to hold third parties liable for these school shootings and for these types of things. We saw that in Michigan, where the two parents were convicted of allowing their child to have this gun when he had clear signs of mental illness and threats and was not getting him the counseling he needed, and they're serving pretty lengthy sentences. There was a Georgia father who is behind bars for allowing his son to have a gun and to not take care of his issues. And we're just seeing more and more of these cases. Even in Uvalde and some of these school shootings, they're trying to hold the police officers responsible for not responding correctly. What do you make of this? Do you think this is a good thing to hold third parties liable criminally for the acts of children?
I think it's a very fact-specific question and case-specific question. If you have a situation where a parent knows that their child has mental health issues and has problems in the past, and it's dangerous, and they still give them access to a gun, you're getting pretty close to the level of criminal conduct. When you get to a situation like the police officer, who I believe was acquitted, who maybe didn't respond as quickly as he should have, or things like that, you're moving further away from criminal conduct. Now, did he do his job the right way? No. Could you argue that, you know, he was afraid? Or yes, but we're talking about a crime. So I think you're always going to have these battles. And that's where prosecutors need to use discretion. What cases rise to that level, or are they just being responsive to sort of this public outcry for convictions and things like that? But, you know, the laws are written the way they're written, and I think that you have to really have a significant case of a parent, because they know the kids better than anybody, really falling below that standard, which we saw, I think, clearly in Michigan. But, yeah, that's every criminal case, you got to look at the facts. You can't have a blanket sort of view of it.
And I guess the bottom line is you can't ignore the signs. You just can't, no matter who we are, whether you're a teacher.
Absolutely.
Or a parent, because we know that we know now that it's happening. In fact, I was just looking at the paper before I came here, and apparently there was a Plainfield boy who had a whole manifesto, and he had guns and knives and accelerators and all kinds of things, and was getting ready maybe to do something in a school, and a family member took him down, you know, and so he's, you know, so that's good. That's a good thing. And when you see those, yeah, exactly. Who knows what could have happened? So let's talk about this disgraced South Carolina attorney, Alex Murdaugh. I think this is going to be a subject of podcast and docudramas for the rest of our lives here. He was convicted in 2023 of killing his wife and son. He was a very prominent lawyer in South Carolina. He came from a long-standing family, very wealthy. He was convicted resoundingly, and it turns out that the Supreme Court in South Carolina overturned the verdicts. And one of the reasons was misconduct by a court clerk. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened and why you think this was, and it was a overturning by, it was a unanimous opinion.
It was 100% the right opinion, first of all, whether or not Murdaugh was guilty, which I think the jury decided correctly and maybe resoundingly. What happened in that case was you had a clerk, and a clerk's job is to ensure that the administration of the day-to-day activities of the judge and the juries get done. Their jobs are not to try to put their finger on the scale of justice. In this case, there was evidence that the clerk was talking to jurors outside of the presence of the judge and the court and all these other things, and making comments about Mr. Murdaugh, saying don't believe him, saying that he was guilty. You cannot have that occur. Clerks are supposed to do nothing else than make the jurors' lives easier, make the judges' lives easier, work with the lawyers. And in this case, the Supreme Court was 100% correct, because it really struck at the heart of the jury system. Hard enough with media and social media for defendants to get a fair trial for things that are going on outside of the courtroom. But when you have people who work inside the courtroom trying to ensure somebody's guilt, the Supreme Court could have done nothing other than what it did, saying he needs a new trial. And kudos to them for doing that in such a high-profile case.
Exactly, because I'm sure it wasn't a popular opinion. I will tell a quick story. I probably have told it before, but I tried a six-week jury trial. It was a civil matter, and it was during the Christmas holidays, and it was getting very close to Christmas, and the jury came back, and later the jurors told me that the clerk had told them, if you don't make a decision quickly here, you're going to be sequestered during Christmas. Which wasn't true. No judge is going to sequester a jury during Christmas. And I don't know what her purpose in saying that was. And it wasn't just one juror. It was several jurors who told me that. And it turns out I won the verdict, and it was a good verdict for my client. So I had the I had the choice whether to appeal and risk an overturning and having to do it over again and maybe not getting the good verdict. But I certainly reported it. And I will tell you, to this day, I am just angry beyond belief that a clerk, after all the work we put in and after, you know, we had like 20 different expert witnesses, we had 60 other witnesses, and all the time that the jurors put into this, and it could have been all for naught. Just by some clerk being mouthy and saying something completely inappropriate. So I agree with you, Damon. I think that Murdaugh is guilty, but you can't let that verdict stand with that kind of misconduct.
Absolutely. And, you know, most clerks that I deal with them every day are great.
Yes.
All of them that I've dealt with in federal court and state court, they do their job. Nobody wants to, you know, miss holidays. I've had cases that have gone right up to Christmas, but you got to do your job and you got to remember what your role is. My role is to argue for my client. The government's role is to argue against. It's not the role of the clerk or even the judge to show their opinion or make comments about the evidence.
No, because I think the jurors can be, I'm not saying they're naive, but they can be swayed. And when you have a judge who's rolling his eyes or doing something when a witness is up there, who knows how that could possibly affect a verdict in someone's life, whether they walk free or not. So these are very, very serious matters. And it's going to be interesting to see this retrial, to see how everything turns out. Thank you so much for joining us on this Memorial Day weekend. Damon Sharonis, one of the best lawyers in town. If you have criminal matters you want to discuss with him, you can contact him at
SharonisLaw.com.